usually translated to English as the monkey mind. And if you don't know this particular expression, you might be much more familiar with the actual mind itself. Monkey mind. And the kind of term that I use for that expression for myself is this kind of surface chatter of the mind. And there's all this kind of incessant, busy, not always busy, but a surface chatter of mind that sometimes has nothing to do with anything in particular, or sometimes has a lot to do with our self-centeredness or our ego-centeredness. And I think part of the reason, there are two reasons why it's called the monkey mind. One is that monkeys are supposed to swing from tree to tree, constantly grabbing every branch, all four limbs, all five limbs, right? And so that's how our mind is constantly grabbing everything. That's one reason. And the other reason is apparently, you probably heard this before also, is apparently one way of trapping monkeys is you take a coconut and you hollow out a hole and you put some wonderful treat inside, but the hole just big enough so that the monkey can put his hand in flat, kind of. But when you grab the candy, you make a fist, and the fist can't get out. And the monkeys are so greedy that even though they're stuck in this trap, because the coconut is tied to some tree or something, they see the hunter coming. They don't want to let go of what they're holding on to, so they just can't get out of the trap. And so it's very easy for the hunter to catch. And so maybe that's also kind of a little bit like our mind, when it's really caught on, really caught something that seems juicy, important. And but it's a surface stuff. It's also this world of self-centeredness, and all these surface ideas that we have of who we are, what we should be doing, what we don't like, and all these things are talk to each other across the surface of the mind, and it gets very complicated. And you start having relationships with stuff within the surface mind rather than anything deeper or anything outside of the surface mind. Sometimes people from very deep, wholesome kind of intention from deep in the heart are motivated to do something. So, for example, someone wants to go to medical school, become a doctor. And then they go to medical school and they accrue all these bills and loans. And then they feel, well, in order to kind of pay out like loans, they need to make a lot of money as a doctor. And then they say, well, in order to make a lot of money as a doctor, maybe at least I need to have a good appearance, so that people will pay a lot. So I need to get a very nice car, a nice suit. And then, but if I want to get this nice car, then I have to worry because my spouse or my significant other thinks, you know, that voluntary simplicity is where it's at. So, you know, I have to kind of negotiate, you know, maybe kind of hide the fact that I'm interested in expensive moving cars so I can pay back my loans, because really what I want to do is to serve people. And I don't know if that's, maybe that's a silly example, but I think you get the idea that we can start with some very wholesome intention. And as we try to kind of find ways to make it work, it gets more and more complicated. It's a proliferation of concerns, called prapancha in Pali. In Pali, it's prapancha. And then these proliferation of concerns start talking to each other. And you start having only having relationships with themselves rather than having a relationship with a deeper intention that started it all. So the surface mind. Trungpa. The Tibetan teacher said, the epitome of the human realm is one big traffic jam of discursive thoughts. And it's often said that the world of self-centeredness is in this world of proliferation, which is often talking to itself. And maybe self-centeredness, and maybe another better word is self-knottedness. It's not just simply self-centered, but that centers a knot. And sometimes we have to be like Alexander, the Gordian knot. As the knot unravels, as we quiet the mind in meditation, there's a possibility of dropping below the surface mind and seeing what's deeper down there. However, calmness is not necessarily the same thing as dropping below the surface mind. It's possible to become very calm, but just simply you've calmed the busyness of the surface mind. But it's still the surface mind, just happening slowly. the kind of the superficiality of the concerns are still prevalent. I want to read this quote. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything, is to succumb to violence. By Thomas Merton. We are distracted by distraction. We're distracted from distraction by distraction. Surface mind, the monkey mind. So as we settle in various ways of doing it, meditation is one way, and finding what's below the surface mind, we begin discovering other aspects of ourselves, of our personal reality, and other aspects also of the world around us, the reality around us. And these discoveries then are very important. In the Theravada tradition, I don't know how many of you know, the Theravada tradition is a tradition that this meditation comes out of, more or less a tradition we teach from. The word itself means the way of the elders. And I kind of like that, the way of the elders. Out of respect for the people who have gained wisdom in their years. In the way of the elders, they talk a lot about the vipassana, mindfulness meditation, being a development of seeing what's below the surface, or seeing everything actually. And being seeing underneath the surface of the deeper realms and processes of reality. And they often talk about three characteristics that you see, the process nature of our experience of reality. That it's impermanent, unsatisfactory, and there's no self, there's no agent. However, it's somewhat static, that kind of description, because you talk only about seeing what's there. As we drop below surface mind, the monkey mind, it's not just simply a matter of seeing those kind of elements that are static. It's not exactly static, but there's also seeing the relationships we have with ourselves, within ourselves, and the relationships we have to the world around us and to other people. And one way of talking about this practice is beginning to plummet down to what our deepest request might be. Discover what our innermost request is. Or discover what our deepest intention is. So it isn't simply a matter of seeing, oh, reality is impermanent, but actually feeling in some sense maybe empowered or feeling some kind of connectedness with some very deep intention about how you want to live your life. It's not only a matter of seeing reality, which is the way often vipassana traditionally is talked about, seeing the nature of reality. But it goes beyond that to how you're going to live your life. And that's sometimes forgotten. And you can find that to some degree by plummeting down to the depths of your heart, deepest intention. And that's one thing that happens when we crack through the surface chatter. We begin finding that. So intention becomes very important for Buddhism. And Buddhism has often been described as a religion of intention. What is the intention by which we live by? What is the intention by which we carry ourselves into the world? Can we discover the intentions we already operate on? And then can we see if maybe there's something deeper form of intention? One of the implications of Buddhist doctrine, Buddhist teaching, is that all there really is relationships. That the reality, life, is not so much things, not so much a single self here, but it's the combination of relationships that we have and that are found in the world. And to begin to understand the nature of these relationships and taking care of them. So as we drop below the surface mind, we begin seeing something about underlying, maybe truths, underlying kind of laws of our reality, of our experience. And as I said already, it's often some of these rules or laws of life, are often described as these three characteristics, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and no self. But there are others which are very important also. And I'd like to read one of them, it comes from the Buddha. And this you know, it's kind of a kind of universal kind of law you find in many religions. But instead of adopting it as a law because your religious tradition tells you, when we drop below the surface chatter of the mind, we begin seeing how the cause and effect relationship, how these relationships work within ourselves and outside of ourselves, and we see that this is actually the case. So this is from the Dhammapada. Look how he abused me and beat me, how he threw me down and robbed me. Live with such thoughts and you live in hate. Look how he abused me and beat me, how he threw me down and robbed me. Abandon such thoughts and live in love. In this world, hate never yet dispelled hate. Only love dispels hate. This is the law, ancient and inexhaustible. Hate is never conquered, or hate is never overcome by hate. Hate is overcome only by love. This is chanted repeatedly in the central chants of Theravada tradition in Southeast Asia. I think this is one of these kind of laws. I don't know if laws is the best word. I don't like the word exactly, but I couldn't think of a better one today. Of what happens in reality when you drop below the monkey mind. And I wanted this evening to read some passages from this book called The Peace Pilgrim. And how many of you have not seen this book? Have all the rest of you seen it? That's impressive. This is a fantastic book about a woman who walked across the United States for about 28 years, from the Korean War in 1953 to the time she died in 1981. And she just walked, and she had a shirt that said Peace Pilgrim across it. And this weekend, when I was going to read from this book, I kind of was looking back at the book again to kind of see what her name was, so I could tell people her name. And I discovered that nowhere in the book is her name told. And she never told anybody her name once she started her pilgrimage. She's just known everywhere for 28 years as the Peace Pilgrim. And she said, what's important is the message and not the messenger. And she walked and only had what she could carry in the pockets of her tunic that she had made for herself. So had this little, so basically she, you know, just a toothbrush and a few things. And she had no money. She didn't, there was 28 years, she didn't have anything to do with money, didn't carry a penny. She just walked across the country and was taken care of. She never asked anything from anybody. We just walked, and people would ask her, what are you up to? And then she would explain, well, come and have dinner, come stay with me. Or sometimes she wouldn't, and she'd go days at a time hungry. But she said she never went more than 3 days without food. And she had trained herself by fasting for 45 days once, so she knew that that's no problem. And so she walked for peace. And I guess she's a Christian. She talks about Christianity some. That's kind of, it's a little bit unusual. It's kind of Christianity, perhaps. And I'm going to read a quote where the word God is in there. And normally, I'm going to change the word God because I think she wouldn't mind. So it's something I feel I could read. But before reading the quote, maybe I'll read her definition of God. And maybe then it would be okay for me. So she wanted to know in high school, what is God? What is God? She had a burning desire to know what God was. And no one could really tell her. So she went out into the woods by herself for a long walk through the night. And then came up with this, discovered this, kind of on her own, I guess. So her answer was that we human beings just lump together everything in the universe which is beyond the capacity of all of us. And to all those things together, some of us give the name God. Well, that set me on a search. The first thing I did was to look at a tree, and I said, there's one. All of us working together couldn't create that one tree. Even if it looked like a tree, it wouldn't grow. There's a creative force beyond us. Then I looked at my beloved stars at night, and there's another. There's a sustaining power that keeps planets in their orbits. So that's kind of a nice definition of God, I thought. And Buddhism doesn't care too much, one way or the other, if there is a God or not. It doesn't seem to matter to Buddhists. And that means also that because it doesn't really matter, you can belong to any religion. You can be an atheistic religion, be a Christian or a Jew or whatever, and still practice Buddhism, there's no problem. And Buddhism also says that the universe is created by sustaining force, sustaining creative power. But in Buddhism, that power, the sustaining power that creates the world and the universe, includes ourselves. We also create it. We're also part of what creates it. And Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on that part, that we also create it through our intentions. And one Indian Buddhist philosopher said, the world is created by our intentions. So this is what she said to say. We seem always ready to pay the price for war. Almost gladly we give our time and our treasure, our limbs, and even our lives for war. But we expect to get peace for nothing. We expect to be able to flagrantly disobey nature's laws and get peace as a result. Well, we won't get peace for nothing. And we won't get peace by disobeying the laws of nature. We'll get peace only when we are willing to pay the price of peace. And to a world drunk with power, corrupted by greed, deluded by false prophets, the price of peace may seem high indeed. For the price of peace is obedience to the higher laws. And this is interesting after what I just read from the Buddha. Evil can only be overcome by good, and hatred by love. Only a good means can attain a good end. The price of peace is to abandon fear and replace it with faith. And I would faith that if we obey God's laws, we will receive God's blessings. So I would change that sentence too. The price of peace is to abandon fear and replace it with trust. Trust, just that's enough. The price of peace is to abandon hate and allow love to reign supreme in our hearts. Love for all our fellow human beings over the world. The price of peace is to abandon arrogance and replace it with repentance and humility, remembering that the way of peace is the way of love. The price of peace is to abandon greed and replace it with giving, so that none will be spiritually injured by having more than they need, while others in the world still have less than they need. Interesting statement. So none will be spiritually injured by having more than they need. You ever think that way? I know I was being prepared for the pilgrimage when I made certain choices. For instance, I was in grammar school when I was offered cigarettes from a package, which I did not smoke, but my friends did. In high school, I was offered all kinds of alcohol, which I did not drink, but my friends did. And just after my student days, I was faced with a kind of test, because all of my friends at that time used both alcohol and tobacco. There was such a push towards conformity in those days. They call it peer pressure now, that they actually looked down on me because I didn't do those things. And gathered in someone's living room, I said to them, look, life is a series of choices, and nobody can stop you from making your choices. But I have a right to make my own choices, too, and I have chosen freedom. No one walks so safely as one who walks humbly and harmlessly with great love and great faith. For such a person gets through to the good in others, and there is good in everyone, and therefore cannot be harmed. This works between individuals, it works between groups, and it would work between nations if nations had the courage to try it. Once I was hit by a disturbed teenage boy whom I had taken for a walk. He wanted to go hiking but was afraid he might break a leg and be left laying there. Everyone was afraid to go with him. He was a great big fellow and looked like a football player, and he was known to be violent at times. He had once beaten his mother so badly that she had to spend several weeks in the hospital. Everybody was afraid of him, so I offered to go with him. As we got up to the first hilltop, everything was going fine. Then a thunderstorm came along. He was very terrified because a thunder shower was very close. Suddenly he went off the beam and came for me, hitting at me. I didn't run away, although I guess I could have. He had a heavy pack on his back. But even while he was hitting me, I could only feel the deepest compassion towards him. How terrible to be so psychologically sick that you would be able to hit a defenseless old woman. I bathed his hatred with love, even while he hit me. As a result, the hitting stopped. He said, "You didn't hit back. My mother always hits back." The delayed reaction because of his disturbance had reached the good in him. Oh, it's there, no matter how deeply it is buried. And he experienced remorse and complete self-condemnation. What are a few bruises on my body in comparison with the transformation of a human life? To make a long story short, he was never violent again. He is a useful person in this world today. And there was this time when another man stopped his car to talk with me. He looked at me, not unkindly, but with extreme surprise and curiosity, as though he had just glimpsed a live dinosaur. "In this day and age," he exclaimed, "with all the wonderful opportunities the world has to offer, what under the sun made you get out and walk a pilgrimage for peace?" "In this day and age," I answered, "when humanity totters on the brink of a nuclear war of annihilation, it's not surprising that one life is dedicated to the cause of peace, but rather it is surprising that many lives are not similarly dedicated." Another time, a truck driver pulled his truck to the side of the road and said, "I heard you say over the television something about the endless energy, and I just wanted to tell you that I had it one time. I was marooned in a town by a flood. I got so bored that I finally offered to help, and I got interested in getting people out. I worked without eating, I worked without sleeping, and I wasn't tired. But I don't have it anymore." And I said, "Well, what are you working for now?" "Money," he said. And I said, "That should be quite incidental. You have the endless energy only when you are working for the good of the whole. You have to stop working for your little selfish interest." How often are you worrying about the present moment? The present is usually all right. If you're worrying, you're either agonizing over the past, which you should have forgotten long ago, or else you're apprehensive over the future, which hasn't even come yet. We tend to skim right over the present moment, which is the only moment God gives any of us to live. If you don't live the present moment, you never get around to living at all. And if you do live the present moment, you tend not to worry. For me, every moment is a new and wonderful opportunity to be of service. Few find inner peace, but this is not because they try and fail. It is because they do not try. I perceive the entirely self-centered life as not worth living. If what you are doing will not benefit others besides yourself, it is not worth doing. So she went on this amazing pilgrimage and affected many, many people's lives. And she became apparently very popular. I never heard of her till after she died. But she was invited, the first 10 years, mostly she walked. She walked all the time after that, but then she had so many speaking engagements. And she was on television and radios and all over them. A few times in the 50s she was arrested for vagrancy, which she did, you know, which happened back then. And once she got arrested for vagrancy, and they took all her stuff away, which wasn't much, but yeah, she kept her kind of correspondence, the most recent correspondence, in her shirt. And then when they put her in jail overnight, and then they looked through her correspondence, and there was a letter from the governor of that state. So they let her out. But she went into jail, and beaming, smiling, they put her into this room with four other women in jail. And the women looked at her and said, "Whenever women come into jail, they're either crying or growling. And you're smiling. What's going on with you?" And she said to them, "Well, if you had a day off at home, what would you do?" And there everyone got them singing and telling stories, and they had a great time. So she devoted herself to a life of simplicity, radical simplicity. And claims, she writes, that she just lived in joy the whole time she was in pilgrimage. Just 28 years of joy. Buddhism puts a lot of value also on simplicity, living simple life. One of the virtues in Buddhism is to be content with few things, to find contentment with few things, not need a lot. And what that means for anyone means a different thing for different people, what anybody needs. And she says that herself in here. She says, if you have a family with children, you need to have a secure home, certain things. And, everybody shouldn't be a peace pilgrim like she is, and be that ethic vows of poverty like she has. She lives very much like the way a traditional Buddhist monk or nun would live, or does still live, some of them. Traditionally, Buddhist monks don't keep any money. They don't have any money at all. And they spend a lot of time just walking. And they're not allowed to keep any food overnight. They have to give it away if they have any left over by noon. And it means the next day you don't have any money. So the next day you wake up and you don't have any food either. So basically you go out and see what happens. You have a begging bowl, and usually in those cultures people know what the person's about, so people usually fill the bowl. But she's even more amazing because she didn't even have a begging bowl or any cultural context what she was doing. And many Westerners who ordained as monks in Asia came back to America, committed to continue following the monastic life here in America. And after some months, usually, decided it was too difficult, they couldn't do it, and they gave up their robes. And here's this one woman who managed to do it beautifully. But just like she says, it's not a matter of giving up all your wealth. You have to kind of find out for yourself what it is, what you need to have. Buddhism says the same thing. And it's interesting a little bit that Buddhism, traditionally in Asia, in India, didn't put down wealth. Sometimes we feel that if you're really wealthy, some people in our culture think, it's a little bit funny if you're really wealthy, maybe. And or money has kind of bad, I think it's a bad rap. The West. But in Buddhism, wealth was considered to be a result of past good intentions. You got wealthy. Now, maybe that's kind of naive. But there's a scripture, that's called the Sigalaka Sutta. It means something like advice to lay people. It's like advice on how the lay person should live. And I'll read this and then I'll stop. A piece of it. The friend who is a helper, and the friend in times both good and bad, the friend who shows the way that's right, the friend who's full of sympathy. These four kinds of friends the wise should know at their true worth, and they should cherish them with care, just like a mother with her dearest child. The wise man trained and disciplined, sorry for sexist language, the wise man trained and disciplined shines out like a beacon fire. He gathers wealth just as the bee gathers honey. So in terms of when you're making your money, your wealth or your livelihood, can you make your money the same way that a bee gathers honey, nectar? But the bee goes, and the bee doesn't disturb the flower. It doesn't take away the fragrance from the flower, the beauty from the flower. The flower is kind of left untouched. And can you, when you go about your livelihood, make your money, can you make your money in the same way? Or can your company do it? With wealth so gained, the layperson, can devote it to his people's good. The layperson should divide his or her wealth into four parts. This will bring the most advantage. One part should be enjoyed in whatever way you want. The second part should be put to work. And the fourth part should be set aside as reserve in times of need. So, I don't know if you think about that.
You skipped the third part.
What's the third part?
The two parts should be put to work. Not the second part. So half of it should be put back into work, invested, I guess, or something. I'm a little bit surprised because the feeling in Buddhism, a lot of these kind of texts, is if you have wealth, it's only good to have wealth if you use it for other people's benefit. And that's not one of the four parts. So I'm
looking
for
it. Well, sort of, isn't it? Could they mean that by putting it to work?
It could mean put it to work. And
not necessarily to make more money.
It could also be the first part, where you enjoy it at will. It's said in Buddhism that you shouldn't give unless your joy in giving is greater than the joy of the person receiving. So the surface mind, the chatter mind. There's an expression in Buddhism called noble silence. The silence that happens when the monkey mind is quiet is deeper and more profound than any kind of external silence you'll ever know. Do you have anything you would ask or add this evening? Anything that needs to be added? What's the line?
When she was talking about love overcoming hate, it seems to me that in my experience, when I feel that I've been hurt by someone, it doesn't do just to forgive the person I've done quite by Christian notion. One of the first things that has to happen, the first thing that has to happen, is to really fully realize what my hurt is about and have a lot of compassion for being so constituted that I am hurt as a result of whatever the person did. And then what happens is what the person did really becomes irrelevant. It just drops away. After I have fully seen wherein I was certainly had the compassion for it. And then it really isn't even a question anymore of the dignity of the person. Because of the harm ended up being done. And this is true of some rather amazing harms. Now there had to be a physical harm, like causing blindness, and no one has ever heard that child, for instance, has happened to be that very patient.
You know, of course, it's very important to honor, respect, and acknowledge what's really going on with us in terms of our feelings, and not to gloss over them. There's some kind of idealistic stance about love. And in a sense, perhaps, you know, if you understand your own choices, your own responsibility, it's easy to kind of let it go, in a sense. I think for this peace pilgrim, there was a man, this man came to her with all this hate. And she didn't have any hate. All she had was love. But it wasn't that she didn't care. It wasn't that it didn't matter for her. I think it mattered very much for her, what was going on, and his well-being. So it's not simply a matter of kind of resolving your own deal, your own side of it, and then kind of walking away. I think the relationship is still very important. And if we just walk away from it, and not try to take care of it in some realistic way, we do also kind of additional violence to ourselves at times. But we have to start with where we are and respect ourselves and take everything into account. It's too easy, I think, to take religious teachings and plug them in, program them in to the surface mind, to the monkey mind. And it just becomes one more thing the monkey mind is trying to deal with, and it has nothing to do with what's deeper, more deeply going on. So if you hear about love and neighborly love, and you do it just from the surface mind, it doesn't have much sincerity, it doesn't work. That's why the kind of movement of positive thinking that has been somewhat popular in the West is looked upon a little bit skeptically by Buddhists, because it's too easy for just to be kind of reorganizing the surface mind and not really kind of reaching down to the roots. This book is available for free, this Peace Pilgrim book. And after she died, five of her friends, also anonymous, gathered together her writings and stuff that she jotted together over the years and put it into this book and then offered it for free. And for many years, it's the only way you can get it was for free. And now they've come out with a trade version, trade copy, that you can buy in bookstores. But you don't have to go out to the bookstore. Just so the bookstores, they want everybody to be happy, so make a bookstore owners happy too. and you can just write away to this address, it's in the jacket, and they'll send it to you.
Hope you get more copies out that way, actually.
And then it says somewhere, actually this copy doesn't say this. Another copy that I've seen, it says something about if you'd like to make a donation, the donation will go towards further printings. But you know, it's basically they're open for you. Yes? You're going to do this evening? Actually, the book is here. It's on the copyright page in the back. And the copyright says, this book is copyrighted only to prevent it being misused. People working for peace, spiritual development, and the growth of human awareness throughout the world by willing permission to reproduce material from this book. Okay, thank you all. Good night. And it's going to be impossible. But if you can be really on top of it, moment by moment, to the way in which we react to this, to the pain, the way we respond to it, interpret it, hate it, and all these things, be there really present moment by moment, you can stay composed and it can be manageable to be with the pain. But you can't let a second go by because then the mind will kind of take over the situation. If the mind takes over, then it's, you know, it takes a while to get composed again. I'm not recommending this to anybody.
But at the end of, so it's 5 to 10 days, and no one tells you how long it's going to be, between 5 and 10. But it depends. But it depends on how well you sat. And if you seem to have sat, if you were really restless and kind of did move around a little bit, then it's longer. But if you sat really well, then it's shorter. So you're sitting and you don't know how long you're going to be there. And at some point, this person came and tapped me on my shoulder and, you know, told me, that's it. And when they told me it was it, I started crying. And the reason I started crying was that I felt the feeling I had that time was that I would never have that level of intimacy with myself as I had with that pain. And I was never going to put myself in that situation again. So that intimacy was so precious. And so I kind of cried a little bit, feeling I was going to lose that. And just to end in more on a happy note, you should know that after a while I learned that you can have that intimacy without using pain as the vehicle for it. Just you practice your mindfulness. And it'll come arise with mindfulness. So sitting with pain, there's a lot more I could say. I'm sorry that I talked over now, and I thought it was a short subject. And there's so much more to say. But I'll say one thing more about how to work with pain, and then I'll read a poem. And hopefully that's you really patient enough for that. The last thing to say is that one of the things you can do with any kind of pain, whether it's psychological, emotional, or physical, is practice loving kindness with it. And it's often a good idea anyway, because the basic attitude of mindfulness practice is an attitude of loving kindness to your experience. And we have so little loving kindness to the parts of ourselves that are difficult, like pain, that you can actually send loving kindness to your physical pain and kind of hold it there. And it's a way of being present for it in a soft and gentle way. And it's that soft and friendly, gentle way of being that we want to find with all our experience. And working with pain, we're not working with pain to be stoic or become, you know, great warriors or become, you know, samurais or whatever it is. If we work with pain, and you can choose how much you work with it, you can work, ride your edges and pull back, and you don't have to kind of jump into it all. But if you work with pain, to develop the capacity to be friendlier to your experience in the long term, to be a friendlier, more open-hearted person, and not to become a tough kind of whatever. And pain is often a symptom, and it's often as a symptom, it often opens up to aspects of our life that we need to attend to, whether it's emotional, psychologically, or whatever. And it's very useful to spend some time going through it and unraveling what needs to be unraveled as you do it. So then I'll end with a poem. And this is a poem by Rumi. And I wouldn't be surprised. I found later on, after I found this poem, a quote by Socrates. And since Socrates was very important for the Aryan world, I wouldn't be surprised if this quote inspired the poem. Socrates wrote, or said, "Pain and pleasure are never present to a person at the same instant, and yet the person who pursues either is compelled to take the other." I think it's nice. The person who pursues either, if you pursue pleasure, watch out. You're asking for it. There's nothing wrong with pleasure. It's the pursuit of it sometimes, which can, not necessarily always, but it can get you in trouble. One dervish said to another, "What was your vision of God's presence?" The other said, "I haven't seen anything, but for the sake of conversation, I'll tell you a story. God's presence is there in front of me, a fire on the left, a lovely stream on the right. One group walks towards the fire, into the fire, another toward the sweet flowing water. No one knows which are blessed and which not. Whoever walks into the fire appears suddenly in the stream. A head goes under on the water surface. That head pokes out of the fire. Most people guard against going into the fire and so end up in it. Those who love the water of pleasure and make it their devotion are cheated with this reversal. The trickery goes further. The voice of the fire tells the truth, saying, "I am not fire. I am fountainhead. Come into me and don't mind the sparks." If you are a friend of God, fire is your water. You should wish to have 100,000 sets of moth wings so you can burn them away one set a night. You've seen a musician make a bowl of rice. No, I don't want to read that. One molecule mote second thinking of God's reversal of comfort and pain is better than attending ritual. That splinter of intelligence is substance, the fire and water themselves, accidental, done with mirrors. So I certainly don't wish you any pain, and I certainly wish that you don't push too much with pain, but I don't wish that you avoid pain either. And finding the middle way, Buddhism is the middle way, and we should always remember that. It's always a good teaching. And what's the middle way between pleasure and pain? I think the middle way is to be open to whatever life gives you and find your composure there. So, thank you all.